Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is United States against Padillo. Mr. Albers.
Good morning. Dan Albers for Appellant Leobardo Lara. May it please the court? Mr. Lara was entrapped as a matter of law. And I think if you consider the facts, the undisputed facts in the record with respect to what happened, the entrapment is startling. Mr. Lara owned a landscaping business up in McHenry County. Mr. Lara had no involvement with the drug shipment at all. Before the government became involved, he had no knowledge and no involvement with the other defendants. He went to work at a warehouse unit that he rented. He cleans his equipment there. He maintains the equipment there. He didn't know anything about this shipment. The government intercepted a shipment of marijuana in clay containers coming from Mexico to an unknown address, a non-existent address up on River Road in McHenry.
So, Mr. Albers, I was interested in this argument, but what I'm thinking about, actually, is whether this is one of those situations where there was enough evidence in the record going either way that there should have been an instruction to the jury. That's obviously one of the arguments you're making. You're starting with your stronger argument, which is that there wasn't even any evidence. But the government cites evidence suggesting that Mr. Lara himself said he wasn't coerced. And I wonder if you could address why that isn't at least enough to make a jury issue.
Except everything that Mr. Lara said is true, except that he didn't believe he was coerced or that there wasn't any special inducement. And then I ask you to accept everything that the government's agent, Agent Warren, said was true. And if you accept all that is true and construe it all the government's way, there's no question under this court's en banc ruling in Hollingsworth that he was not predisposed as a matter of law. The court held in Jacobson, the United States Supreme Court, which this court followed in Hollingsworth, and it's been cited over 100 times, including over 30 times in this circuit, that the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Lara was predisposed independent of and prior to any actions of the government. He was not predisposed. And I would ask you to consider, what was he predisposed to do? What was Mr. Lara, what did he wake up that morning? He was not a known criminal. He wasn't a drug dealer. He wasn't a government official that was in a position to take bribes. He wasn't a gun dealer to sell guns illegally. What was he predisposed to do? He went to work, and he certainly didn't go there predisposed, hoping that someone would show up with a two-ton shipment of marijuana so he could help unload it. And that's all he did. His forklift, he took the marijuana, he took the clay pots, and he just took them from the truck and put them on the ground. So if you construe that all most favorably to the government, there is no predisposition as a matter of law. That's my position on that.
If all the evidence shows, then your client is innocent because he doesn't have the required mental state. What is the argument that even if a jury can properly find that he had the required mental state, he was nonetheless not predisposed or nonetheless entrapped?
You've got predisposition and inducement, which I think the court has held are kind of like two sides of the same coin.
Not two sides of the same coin. It's easy to see how somebody can be induced to do something that he really wanted to do anyway.
Okay. Mr. Lara did not really want to do this anyway.
Most drug transactions that the government sets up, the government induces somebody to do something that he was in the business of doing.
And Mr. Lara was not in the business
right.
of doing this.
But look, just let's go back to my question. My question is, the argument you gave in response to Judge Wood's question was essentially, my client is innocent. He did not have the mental state or knowledge required to violate the statute. But that's not an argument for entrapment. That's an argument for acquittal on the ground the government didn't prove all the elements of the claim. I'm asking whether there's a distinct argument for entrapment which could be made even if, as the jury found, your client did have all the knowledge required for conviction.
Well, I'm not sure I would agree the jury found that because I don't think the jury had the opportunity to address that issue.
You were to convict him.
Okay. I am not.
The jury convicts him only of the possession with intent to distribute. It doesn't convict him on the conspiracy.
Correct. He got a not guilty on the conspiracy. Maybe I'm not understanding your question, Your Honor.
Convict him of possessing marijuana with intent to distribute. It had to find that he knew it was marijuana rather than some innocent substance and that he intended to distribute. The jury found as a fact that your client had that knowledge and that intent.
I'm not making the argument. Maybe I'm not being clear, and I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm not making the argument that he's innocent because he didn't have the requisite mental state for possession with intent. I'm making the argument that...
But I thought you were in part making that argument in the section of your brief where you were saying there should have been a lesser included offense instruction, because it was my understanding that your point was that the universe is not filled up with intent to distribute 943 kilograms and personal use, that perhaps Mr. Lahr intended to abandon it. Perhaps he, you know, had some other intent. I mean, personal use is absurd here, but 943 kilograms.
That's a ton of marijuana.
Yes, it is, in fact, a ton of marijuana.
It's a lot of marijuana.
But I thought the government immediately said, well, if it's that much marijuana, you must intend to distribute it. It was my understanding in the other part of your brief, you were saying that there was actually another possibility, that he intended to abandon it once it was on the ground.
Correct. I am making that argument.
And that would be that's getting back to Chief Judge Easterbrook's point, I think. That would go beyond simply an entrapment or lesser included offense. That would suggest innocence of the offense that was the only one the jury was asked about.
Well, there's two different arguments, maybe if I can clarify. That argument is that the judge wouldn't give the instruction for the lesser included on the basis of the amount of marijuana. And I think that was error, because there is case law that says you can draw that inference from the amount, but you can also not draw the inference. And so he was entitled to the lesser included instruction. In fact, the reason the judge didn't give it was because of the conspiracy charge. He said, well, it's conspiracy with intent to deliver, and therefore he wouldn't give it. But the lawyer at trial counsel said, what happens if he's found not guilty in the conspiracy, which is what happened. So I'm not saying he's innocent as a matter of law. What I'm saying on that point is he is entitled to the lesser included jury instruction. That was there. As far as your point, Judge Easterbrook, what I'm arguing is assume that he said that, yes, he understood it was marijuana and that he possessed it. He was entrapped as a matter of law because he was not predisposed as a matter of law, considering all of the facts most favorably to the government.
Well, so, the district court suggested that Warren and the others didn't make any promises or threats specifically to Laura. Is it your position that he was there or in the area when certain statements were made by the agent? So even if they weren't prefaced with Mr. Laura, they still effectively were made to him?
They were effectively made to him, and the agent, and Agent Warren made direct statements to him, and his agent, Nardo, the driver who was acting at the government's behest, made direct statements to him, and the landlord, who was paid $1,000 to participate, made direct statements
to him.
Right,
but they were not threats, right?
They weren't threats.
Right,
and
were not promises.
The court found in Hollingsworth that for an ordinary person who's not someone who's a criminal waiting to act, that there don't have to be extraordinary inducements or threats. There's no question he was induced by government acts. But what the court got hung up below was that it wasn't extraordinary inducement. The court required that. And after Jacobson and Hollingsworth, that's not required for someone who's in this position. And what was the result of this? What did they do? Did getting Laura involved help them solve this crime? No. Did it help them find the real drug dealers who were making the sales? No. What did it do? It pulled in someone who had no predisposition, and now he's spending 8 years in jail because he helped unload from the truck to the ground as a favor to his landlord, who represented to him, by the way, it's okay to do this. And this is a person who doesn't speak English well, and he doesn't understand that what was happening as well as maybe perhaps you and I would. And the landlord says to him, go ahead and do this. I will take responsibility. And that's why he did it. He wasn't paid. He didn't ask to be paid. And he didn't ask to be involved in this. And now because he did a favor, he's in jail for 8 years and in danger of being deported.
So
and that's wrong.
So what do we make of his getting the gun, leaving to get a gun?
I think the only thing that I think that's reasonable to make of that.
Couldn't he have just walked away if he didn't want to get involved, or, you know?
That was the second issue that was error below. The judge said below you could have just walked away. And in Hollingsworth, this court said en banc, that's not the standard. In every entrapment case, you could have just walked away. And that's not going to be the basis. In fact, if that had been true, then Jacobson, the Supreme Court would have found that he was predisposed as a matter of law.
But
that's been rejected.
This gun was an affirmative act on his part.
He was protecting himself. He didn't use the gun to protect the drugs. He used the gun to protect himself until he could leave. He's now involved with these people. He doesn't know who they are. He's afraid. That's why he had the gun. And that's the only reason the gun went into evidence. So I ask that you reverse. Reverse outright or reverse because of the failure to give the instructions.
Thank you, Mr. Albers. Mr. Byrd.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Your Honors, Counsels, good morning. My name is Mark Bird, and I represent the appellant Israel Piatto in this appeal. Mr. Piatto received a 150-month sentence for his involvement in this offense, and the first argument that I'll be making to Your Honors today is that that sentence should be vacated and remanded because the sentence was clearly erroneous in terms of the guideline calculations and that it was unreasonable, an abuse of discretion, and in violation of the parsimony provision of Section 3553A. The standard of review on this, as the Court's aware, is de novo review of the judge's United States Sentencing Guideline findings, and those are then reviewed for clear error. It's our position that Mr. Piatto, given the minimal nature of his involvement in this conspiracy, should have received a minimal role adjustment under Section 3B1.2.
Now, doesn't that depend, though, on how the rest of the evidence is to be understood? Because it seems that there is a link between Mr. Piatto and this Huerta name that is there on the manifest and that is the name that the van winds up getting licensed under in a somewhat bizarre transaction, I have to say. So if Mr. Piatto is really Huerta, then isn't he much more deeply involved than his cautious behavior would suggest?
While Your Honor is correct and there is a link, the only evidence in the case suggested that the only reason that the name Alfonso Huerta appeared on the registration papers to the van Mr. Piatto was driving was prior to leaving to give Mr. Gonzalez a ride to McHenry. They stopped at a currency exchange on 26th and Keeler. Mr. Gonzalez went in and purchased the registration for Mr. Piatto and put the name Huerta on there.
Right, but the thing is, looking at the transcripts of the conversations that the government put, or I forget who put it, but anyway, that are in the appendix, you can see that during these various phone calls that Agent Warren makes to the car, where Mr. Piatto's story is he's just translating for Gonzalez, but the transcripts are what the transcripts are. I presume somebody could either believe that or not believe that. I thought the name Huerta also was coming up in those conversations.
It was, Your Honor. Mr. Piatto, and I think you can look to the facts that occurred the night before when Maria acted as an interpreter. Agent Warren, one thing was clear. He spoke very little or no Spanish. And Mr. Gonzalez, on the other hand, spoke very little or no English. So in order for this exchange to be facilitated, they needed an interpreter. Griselda Gomez, Maria, served that purpose the night before. When my client was not present and Mr. Gonzalez at that time wanted to unload the shipping container to the ground, and Mr. Piatto served that role the following day en route because without him to facilitate the communication, there would have been none between Mr. Gonzalez and the special agent in the case. And while Your Honor, Your Honor's point may certainly go to the weight of the evidence for purposes of the conviction, it doesn't take away from the otherwise minimal role that the defendant played. As I argued in the district court, and I believe the evidence bears this out, he was essentially nothing more than Plan B, a courier who gave Mr. Gonzalez, who we know is from Mexico, sent here just a couple of weeks before the shipment arrived. He was essentially the individual that was sent to facilitate moving it from its destination in McHenry County to wherever it was supposed to go. The fact that Mr. Piatto wasn't present the night before when Maria and her husband Manuel Gomez showed up with Mr. Gonzalez to unload further supports that this was a much broader conspiracy than what was charged and that he essentially played a very minor role in it. The evidence also demonstrated that he was at the scene for a total of 10 to 12 minutes on three occasions that day, compared to what the other co-defendants' involvement was. He was never any closer, according to the agent, than 10 to 15 feet of the shipment. He never looked at it or examined its contents. He never handled it. He did nothing to unload it. Despite the agent's best efforts to get him to sign the shipping manifest, he refused to do that. When questioned by her co-defendant Hernandez, according to Hernandez, he shied away like he wanted nothing to do with him and told him, you need to talk to Gonzalez. He played no role in unloading the shipment. Now, the district court drew an inference that because he was there in a cargo van, he was obviously there to unload the shipment. And I believe that that would be an unreasonable inference given the size. This shipping container was essentially a semi-truck.
Well, there's no way you could put that much marijuana in a cargo van without breaking the suspension.
Exactly. And the judge speculated perhaps they could break these hundreds of clay pots, leave the shards there, and put the marijuana in the van.
There's still 963 kilos of marijuana.
It was quite voluminous. And
so in other words, unless this was a cargo van of rather extraordinary capability, you couldn't have put all of it in there.
And even more importantly, Your Honor, as the agent went to great detail in trial, this whole sting operation was designed to not alert anybody to the fact that it was, in fact, a sting operation. If Mr. Piatto was there for unloading the shipment, he had ample opportunity to take even one brick and put it in that cargo van, and no effort was made in that regard whatsoever. The government, ironically, in their brief, cites to a provision from the Hill case that I argued in the district court at page 59 of the government's brief, and that discusses what I urge the court to do, and that is view Mr. Piatto's involvement just not vis-a-vis the five individuals that were there, but rather the overall broader conspiracy, and that's what this court suggested in Hill, where it talks about Hill's possession of the guns was but one step in a longer sequence of events through which firearms were obtained by burglary, then sold to the CI. That context should not be treated as an isolated act in which only he was involved, but rather one step in a broader scheme that involved multiple participants. Another case that applied former application note 2 talked about, and that's the Hunty case, a minimal participant is one who unloads a single shipment of marijuana in a large-scale smuggling operation. That individual would be entitled to a minimal role, and my guy did nothing to even unload. We argued mere presence. We believe that the court should have considered giving him the downward departure for a minimal role. As far as the parsimony provision, this individual was a 20-year-old with no criminal history whatsoever, never been convicted of anything. His minimal involvement in this offense merited a sentence far less than 1 month below the absolute maximum of the guidelines, which was 151 months. The judge gave him 150 months. Your Honors, it's our position that that violates the parsimony provision. This individual, with his lack of record and his minimal involvement, deserved a much lesser sentence, and to not give him a lesser sentence than that, I respectfully submit, constitutes an abuse of discretion under United States versus Pape from this court in 2010. While Rita and Mikutuk mandate that the guideline range or guideline sentence be presumptively reasonable, I believe on the facts of this case that presumption can be and has been rebutted. I suggested a sentence of 5 years in the district court and that the 3553A factors would have been amply met with such a sentence. Because the district court failed to consider that or give him a sentence below the 150 months, it's our position that that was an abuse of discretion and unreasonable. I see that I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Byrd. Mr. Nelson here yet? Very well. Mr. Peterson?
May it please the court. Defendant Lara was not entrapped as a matter of law, and the district court properly refused to give an entrapment instruction at the close of the evidence.
Now, Mr. Peterson, I'm going to start with this because I'm very troubled by the government's position on entrapment because I don't see how you are distinguishing a duress defense from an entrapment defense. Obviously, if somebody is under duress, you know, they've got the proverbial gun to the head, then they will do what they're being asked to do. But there's a distinction. You don't have to show duress to show entrapment. Or do you disagree? Do you think you have to meet all of the elements of duress plus more for entrapment?
No, Your Honor.
All right. So there's a difference between the defenses. And in Mr. Lara's case, he admits that he wasn't under duress, you know, that he at some level still retained freedom of action. But this is a man who you know, had his landscaping business, no intention of doing anything about this until the government harangues him. And your brief proceeds as though you think you are defending a motion for acquittal on the basis of insufficiency of the evidence. You're taking all the facts in the light most favorable to the government. But if the issue is whether a jury instruction should have been given, that's not the proper perspective.
Well, there were two arguments that the defense raised. One was that
I'm focusing on the jury instruction argument.
As to that, Your Honor, there's two elements, as you know, to entrapment. One that the defense hasn't really talked about is the government inducement.
And right, talk about it. They say that you essentially have required inducement all the way up to the point of duress. Your extraordinary inducement argument. But, you know, you look at the pattern instruction in the Seventh Circuit, you look at a number of cases, and the kind of the degree of inducement is a factor, but it's not the only factor.
I agree, Your Honor, and
so you agree it doesn't have to be extraordinary inducement in the extent Agent Warren doesn't have to be saying, you know, if you try to leave here, I will block your way, or I'm going to kidnap your wife, or anything.
Well, typically this court has found that in order for there to be inducement, there has to be some threat, extraordinary promise, or some type of fraud by the government.
Right, and there is some type of fraud by the government. The agent is saying, you know, we can't move the truck when that's obviously wrong. The agent is saying we're going to call your landlord, the guy that you rent from. The agent is causing the driver to lie. The agent's lying right and left and making this man feel that he's got no choice but to bring his forklift over and putting this stuff on the ground.
Well, I respectfully disagree that was the evidence, Your Honor. There was statements made by the agent, but those statements were all directed to Gonzalez, defendant who showed up to unload the truck. Lara was standing there when some of those statements were made, but by his own admission, when he was testified, he testified that the agents made no threats and no promises to him, and that the only reason he unloaded the container was as a favor to his landlord.
Well, in Lara's brief on page 6, there are citations to the transcript. Agent Warren pretends to call the landlord. Of course, actually, Warren has already spoken to the landlord. Warren tells Lara, well, it needs to be effing unloaded. It has to be unloaded here. Tells him he can't leave.
But, Your Honor, there's a...
opened. He tells him that the landlord says it's okay. He tells him the landlord wants it out of here.
Well, those were all statements made by Agent Warren to Gonzalez.
To Lara, too. Lara says it's to Lara, too. I mean...
Lara was not responsible for the truck. And
But Lara was present standing
he was
there
present
with all these statements.
He was standing around with a bunch of other people.
I mean, that's
that
like
also
saying you're talking to me right now and not talking to Chief Judge Easterbrook and Judge Williams. I mean, we're all here. We can hear you.
I'm not listening to
that, but if I'll speak louder. But if you're a customer in a store and you're having a discussion with the clerk and I'm in line and you're making statements to the clerk and I'm standing there hearing it, their statements are not directed at me, but yes, I'm hearing them. That's my point, is that Lara was not, and by his own admission, when he testified, he said that he was not threatened and no promises were made.
That's your side of things. That's why I think there might be a jury issue here. Lara says he wasn't threatened, by which he probably means nobody pulled a gun on him, but Nardo tells Lara, at Agent Warren's behest, that Lara's landlord says it's okay. He's not talking about Gonzalez right there. Gonzalez doesn't have a landlord.
Well, that was after a long discussion between Gonzalez and Lara, which we don't know what was being said.
I mean, it's Lara who's being importuned by the government to get swept into this thing.
All he was told was that the landlord said it was okay. That's not an inducement.
Lara isn't in this business. Lara's a landscaping business, and it's the government that persuades Lara for no money, to do this. Lara doesn't take any of the marijuana. He doesn't take any of the money. The government doesn't seem to realize that Lara, which his behavior shows, is perfectly happy to just leave it on the ground and walk away. He didn't care if it washed away in the next rain. Why does that show intent to distribute?
Well, why does Lara's action
show... Putting
it
on the ground and walking away from it.
Well, are we going on to the simple possession instruction?
Well, I mean, I just feel like you're very weak on government inducement. You're very weak on predisposition. We can then move on to whether there...
Well, before we move on, just to go back to the inducement, there was a language barrier between Lara and the agents. He didn't speak English. He had an interpreter at trial. And that's my point, is that there were statements made.
Why does that make it better for you that he was predisposed? He resists and resists, and you've got all sorts of people talking to him before he relents and does this.
Well,
I mean, why is the government in this business? I mean, it's just so unseemly.
Well, we're in the business of, there was a container shipped of marijuana from Mexico to...
Trying to catch other people who had nothing to do with the shipment and put them in prison forever.
Well, and I have the same problem. When you look at the language in Jacobson, the description of entrapment is the apprehension of an otherwise law-abiding citizen who, if left to his own devices, likely would never run afoul of the law. This guy didn't know the organizers before the day. It was just a favor. You know, that's a jury question.
Well, as to the predisposition...
And the whole issue of how much he understood and all that, that would go to the jury to make that decision.
But there has to be some evidence of government inducement, and that's our argument, that there was no government inducement for him to be involved in unloading the container.
There's plenty of evidence of government inducement that a jury could believe. A jury might not believe that there was government inducement either. The jury might think that Laura's statements were more persuasive, or that there wasn't quite enough, or that somehow, I mean, I can imagine that the government might prevail had there been a jury instruction, but I can't see how this isn't at least a jury issue.
Because there was no inducement by the government for Laura to become involved.
Well, you keep saying that, but that doesn't make it so.
Well, there was no money offered. By his own admission, he wasn't going to get paid any extraordinary amount. That's usually one of the factors for entrapment or a government inducement. He wasn't told that if he didn't do it, he was going to be, you know, harmed or
again,
his family
duress.
Was going to be hurt.
I mean, so, yes, we'll all agree that he wasn't under duress.
So is it your position that the landlord was not acting on behalf of the government?
Well, his statement giving permission, that's not an inducement to the
defendant. No, is it your position the landlord was not acting on behalf of the government? Because as I understand it, he was only there and only said that the unloading was fine because Warren asked him. So, you know, I want to know, do you think the landlord was acting on behalf of the government?
The record is clear that that Agent Warren did ask the landlord to
give permission.
So he
was acting on behalf of the government?
Correct. But, again, that's not... all he did was give him the opportunity. He didn't induce him to commit the crime. There's a distinction there. And, I mean, if the government is held to a standard where if any type of providing the opportunity for a defendant to commit a crime, anyone that commits their first crime is going to be able to claim that they were entrapped because there's no evidence that they ever committed a crime before and the government presented them this opportunity. Therefore, they were not predisposed and now they have a valid entrapment defense. I mean, there has to be some type, and that's what this court has held, that there has to be some type of threat, extraordinary promise, or fraud to the point that is an inducement for them to commit the crime. In this case, the only possible inducement is the landlord saying, yes, it was okay. And
also the lengthy period of time, you know, Warren is saying to people, I want you to unload this. Laura doesn't do it. He says, I really want you to unload it. Laura doesn't do it. Nardo says, I'll take the truck back. But Warren says, oh, don't do that. You know, it has to be unloaded here. Then Warren pretends to call Doc Roberts. Then Warren says to Laura, it's got to be unloaded. Then he says that the landlord, you know, so this isn't just, you know, here's the truck, unload it.
But
that's what you're saying
those,
it is. But
those
I don't
weren't statements that were directed at Laura to put pressure. Or that a jury couldn't have construed that those statements put pressure on Laura.
Why not?
because he wasn't he's not the one that signed for the shipment. He just happened to be there standing around. And those statements weren't just made to Lara. They were made to several individuals. There's a video that the agent video recording device he was wearing. They weren't directed at Lara individually.
Do you have a working definition of inducement? What do you think the legal requirement is? Forget the facts of this case. And just tell me what you think the legal requirement entails.
It has to be something beyond merely providing the opportunity to commit the offense.
I don't ask whether it's beyond something. Just tell me functionally what the legal requirement entails. Now, I can imagine a rule that says inducement is an effort to overcome professed reluctance. Right? That distinguishes inducement from duress, and it also distinguishes inducement from simply providing a criminal opportunity. Suppose that's a working definition of inducement. Is it present here?
No.
You don't think there were any efforts to overcome professed reluctance to commit the crime?
Oh, Your Honor, I don't.
Okay. Perhaps you will want to go on and say something about Padillo, and you may want to reserve some time to talk about Mr. Gonzalez, because now that Mr. Nelson is here, I will let him argue, and then I'll give you an opportunity to talk about Gonzalez.
Okay. One more point on Mr. Lara, though, as to the simple possession instruction. The jury instructions also included an aiding and abetting provision. So it was proper for the district court to find that no rational jury could have found either that the defendant possessed the marijuana with intent to distribute, or I'm sorry, just simply possessed the marijuana with no intent to distribute, or that he merely possessed the marijuana with the intent to aid and abet its simple possession. I mean, with that amount of marijuana, if the jury found
that, that's the fallacy in your argument there, because it excludes the possibility that he may have intended simply to possess it briefly as he was unloading it from the truck and then to abandon it, that he had no desire to assist in somebody else's distribution, that he didn't care, he wanted to abandon it. You just think there's a lot of marijuana, you must want to distribute it. But there is a possible different mental state. As I say, personal use is absurd. We're not worrying about that, but You think that because there was a lot of marijuana, in every case where there's probably more than an ounce of marijuana, there's absolutely no way somebody can indicate that the mental state to intend to distribute or to aid and abet somebody else's distribution could be disproven.
I'm saying, based on the facts in this case, that Gonzalez attempted...
No, you don't have any room for any facts in any case, because otherwise... The facts in this case suggest that he couldn't have cared less what happened to it afterwards. He could have thrown a match into it.
Well, I think the facts have to be applied to determine whether or not there's some evidence for the jury to conclude that he could have just possessed it with the intent just to simply possess it.
And you don't think there's evidence of that here?
I don't think, based on the fact that Gonzalez spent a lot of time persuading him to help him unload the container, and then him unloading this shipment that he believed, based
right,
on his statement,
the shipment
that
he knows it's
contained
marijuana.
A very large amount of marijuana,
right.
That when he did that, the jury could have found that he did not have the intent to aid and abet, at least aid and abet Gonzalez in possessing it with the intent to distribute.
But again, if we're talking about a jury instruction, you have to be saying that that's the only conclusion a jury
Well, how
could
a rational jury have found that when he helped unload that amount of marijuana that he didn't know that Gonzalez was going to distribute it?
He doesn't care what they do. If they get arrested the next minute, he doesn't. Why does that mean he has to intend to want to help them distribute it? A jury might find that. I would think that would be a very permissible inference. Don't get me wrong. Could find that easily. But it seems to me a jury might find that he was just trying to get them off his back, wanted to leave, wanted to have nothing to do with it, didn't care if they distributed it or not, didn't care if it, you know, washed away in the next rain, really had no such intent.
With that amount and given the nature of how it was packaged.
Why does the amount matter? Suppose it was 1 kilo. Why does the amount have anything to do with his frame of mind?
Because if there's a small amount of marijuana, there's a possibility that...
I think you're missing the point of the question.
Okay.
The amount of the marijuana rules out an argument that he was acquiring it for personal use. Judge Wood, however, is asking a question based on the assumption that a person who moves marijuana around might have reasons other than distribution and personal use. Here might be accommodating a friend, but doesn't care what happens to the marijuana. The question you're being asked is, was there enough evidence to create an issue for the jury on the possibility of a third motive, even if we rule out the personal use motive as absurd? Right? That's the question you're being asked.
No, I don't think there was any evidence for the jury to conclude, given the nature...
Not the fact that he just walked away from it, not the fact that he testified, you know, that the testimony indicates that it was... only with the intervention of the landlord that he even gets involved, not the fact that he doesn't take any of it.
Well,
other people were taking bricks here and there, but he didn't.
He gets no cut. He doesn't get paid. He doesn't get anything.
I mean, I'm just saying that a jury could say that it's that third possibility that the chief judge mentions.
Well, there was additional evidence as well that when the landlord gave permission, he also stated that he wanted the items out of there by tonight and that the defendant indicated he understood. So it was not going to stay there. It was going to be taken somewhere else.
But do you know that he was going to have anything to do with moving them?
No, but
no.
If he ate and embedded...
There's no evidence that he was doing anything but getting it out of the truck.
But he ate it and embedded that as well. I mean, there's no way a jury could have found that he wasn't going to aid and abet that.
If you say so. I mean, maybe you can move on to something, or maybe...
As to Defendant Piatto, the district court did not abuse... the district court did not err when it found that that Piatto did not deserve a mitigating role reduction. The
evidence is extremely thin on Piatto, too. Now, here... In terms of guilt, you have going for you the very favorable standard of review for the government, but if it's over the line at all, it's a pretty gossamer amount.
Your Honor,
he really hardly does anything. You have these telephone calls that the government erroneously says in its brief were originated by Gonzalez and Piatto, but were actually originated by Warren, as the transcripts make very clear. You have this Huerta connection, so you see the name coming up both on the shipment and in connection with Mr. Piatto. And then you have the fact that he gives Gonzalez a ride. That's it.
We also have there were phone calls between the individual, Ramon Meza, who showed up at the end of the operation. He was the individual that Plata left to go find when they arrived, and he dropped off Gonzalez. There were phone calls between Ramon Meza and Plata that morning prior to Plata saying that he first met up with him and just happened to run into him at a restaurant, and he happened to decide to give Gonzalez a ride to this address. In addition, there were also phone records that showed phone calls between Manuel Gomez, who was the individual that was in the van the night before with Gonzalez. After they show up, Agent Warren says, "You're here. You don't have a forklift. You can't unload this without a forklift. It's very heavy."
Yeah, more encouragement of crime. I mean, Gonzalez was perfectly happy to unload the whole thing. Would have taken him quite a while, but the boxes were of a size an individual person could take them out.
Well, one other point I'll just quickly make as well is that you had indicated that the van wouldn't have been large enough. As the district court noted at sentencing, it was a one-ton cargo van. It was one ton of marijuana. It probably may not have fit every single brick, but it would have fit a substantial amount of bricks.
When you say a one-ton cargo van,
yes.
You mean that this van was, you know, capable of hauling a ton?
That was my understanding.
I'm lost now. It was the marijuana was in pots. They were heavy.
But they were...
There was a lot more than a ton here total.
Correct, but the idea would have been that they would be broken out of the pots and then transported. because the way the items were unloaded, there's no way they could have been put back on another truck. The boxes, some of the boxes were broken. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for responding to Mr. Nelson's arguments.
Mr. Nelson. Mr. Nelson, we expect counsel to be here when the case is called for argument. Mr. Byrd, who is also from Rockford, had no difficulty making it on time. You should have been here at 9:30 as well.
Yes, sir, I should have, and I apologize. It is a great honor to be before this court, and I have been before this court for many years now, and I apologize.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I represent represented and represent Arinio Gonzalez, who is from the state of Jalisco. I believe we elicited in the record and cited the fact that Jalisco is a state in Mexico comprising of approximately 90,000 square miles. Certainly, we've argued three issues. First, we joined in a request for entrapment. We would concede that Mr.
I assume you mean you've joined a request for an entrapment instruction.
Yes, sir.
Very few defendants request entrapment.
That is true, Your Honor. We would ask the court, and I understand the standard that the court gave, but we believe inducement is an act or process of enticing or persuading another person to take a certain course of action, and we believe that because that's what our Black's Law Dictionary says.
But, you know, taking the definition that the Chief Judge suggested a little while ago, it strikes me that the facts are somewhat different when we come to Mr. Gonzalez, who does, at least as far as I can tell from this record, seem to have a much more central role in this. And I find it harder to see how anybody could find that Mr. Gonzalez had any pre-existing reluctance that needed to be overcome by government persuasion.
Well, Your Honor, my thoughts on that are that I would concede that it was likely no accident that Mr. Gonzalez showed up on the scene, although his explanation was he was hired to do a job.
Well, but it's Mr. Gonzalez who goes to Mr. Piatto and he needs the ride. It's Mr. Gonzalez who, you know, is there the night before. And Mr. Gonzalez is all over this transaction. So if anybody in this group deserves to be there, it seems to me it might be Mr. Gonzalez.
Well, Your Honor, and I will concede the court makes a good point. You know, when you represent the individuals, you come to understand many things. It's a matter of the record that I did have Mr. Gonzalez examined. He was found fit after, on the eve of trial, he asked me if he should plead guilty. I just don't. My thought is, if Mr. Gonzalez was sent by the drug cartel, he was sent as a someone who was totally expendable. I don't think he knew much, if anything, of what was at stake.
But you've described a lot of people. I mean, that's an unfortunate part of the whole drug trade, if you will, and the problem is it appears that Mr. Gonzalez was, I'll just say that the district, it strikes me that the district court could rationally look at this record and say there's not enough here to justify an entrapment instruction for Mr. Gonzalez in particular. And the judge was very careful to think about each defendant. People had different issues.
Well, Your Honor, I think the reasons for an entrapment instruction for Mr.
Gonzalez. What's your best case that Mr. Gonzalez, you know, A, had no, well, A, was induced by the government, and B, had no predisposition to be involved with this criminal activity?
Well, I think there's an issue, Judge. I mean, the evidence put forward is that he was hired to unload trucks. He was hired in a method and manner in which several Hispanics find jobs.
So trucks with marijuana, trucks with stolen iPads, trucks with lettuce? I mean, what kinds of trucks?
My understanding is, Your Honor, that there are places where Hispanics, many illegal, will go and obtain essentially day labor employment. And they do what they're told, and they work hard at it, and they recoup their benefits economically. Typically, they don't get paid until the job is done. And that would dovetail with Mr. Gonzalez having the ability to request from the court, and the court, I think, considering everything, giving an entrapment instruction. I would also want to point out, Your Honor, that I know that the government and Mr. Lara's attorney are at loggerheads over this, but the permission of the landlord to unload the truck is very significant, and much more so for these particular defendants. I think the record is quite clear when the truck was opened and the marijuana was discovered, they refused to unload it for a period of time until it was that the landlord gave his impromptu.
But was he Gonzalez's landlord too, or just Lara's?
I thought
it was Lara who had the business that was in this like little warehouse row or whatever.
Yeah, that is true. But what I mean is that he was perceived as the owner, the boss of the property, and I think in Mexico that's much more significant than it would be here. And that's why I think that there's a powerful inducement. Your Honor, if I might, I see my time is running short. Was very concerned about the third issue we raised, which was the assessment of leadership against Mr. Gonzalez. In representing Mr. Gonzalez, it was difficult to see how he could manage a two-car funeral. But we believe that is an issue that merits a look by the court.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Nelson.
Thank you.
Mr. Peterson?
I think under any definition of inducement, there was no government inducement as to Mr. Gonzalez by the government. He showed up that first night, and he was willing to unload this truck that had very large pallets that weighed a large amount and unload them by himself by hand. That's how willing he was to unload the truck. So we don't believe that the district court erred in any way in denying an entrapment instruction as to defendant Gonzalez. In addition, as to predisposition, he also didn't indicate any lack of predisposition at all in his willingness to unload the truck. He was the one who persuaded the other individuals to help him unload it the second day. And going to the second argument made by Mr. Nelson regarding the role in the offense, this defendant did exhibit took many actions which showed that he deserved a leadership role in this offense. He was the one that recruited the other individuals to unload the container. He was one who, when he arrived, took responsibility for the shipment, opened it up, inspected the boxes. So the district court did not err when it found that this defendant, Mr. Gonzalez, warranted a role in the offense enhancement. For all those reasons, we'd ask that the court affirm the convictions and sentences of the three defendants, and unless there's any other questions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Alberts, anything further?
Very good, Your Honor. Thank you. I know that
each of you has been in the position I've been in to argue at the trial level and the appellate level. And I called my mom yesterday first and then talked to my dad, and I told him I was worried about this case. I told him I was worried because this is a case I should win. And he said, as long as you're seeking justice, don't be worried about it. And I'm asking this court to give justice to Mr. Lara. I want to answer the questions very briefly that were asked by the panelists of Mr. Peterson. Judge Wood, you asked him if the landlord was acting on the government's behalf, and he said finally that he was. But what he neglected to tell you is what I said in my opening argument. They actually paid the landlord $1,000 to lie to Mr. Lara to induce him to commit this crime. And Judge Wood, you asked him whether he would admit that the law is that there does not have to be a threat of an extraordinary inducement, and he wouldn't agree to that. And the problem with this case is that Mr. Peterson made a mistake of law below in arguing to the trial judge that there had to be extraordinary inducement, when that is not the law. After Jacobson in 1991 and after this court relied on Jacobson in 1994 en banc, the law is, as to a person in these circumstances, there does not have to be extraordinary inducement. You asked, were any efforts made to overcome? Am I done? Thank you.
Done. Anything further?
Your Honors, all I can say with respect to the evidence is that the government has taken the position that Mr. Piatto was there for this, Mr. Piatto was there for that. But when you look at the evidence, there was opportunity, there was all this marijuana, and he's driving this van. If that was his role, and the sting operation was intended so that nobody would know they were involved in a sting operation, there would have been some effort on his part to fulfill that role. The fact that he wasn't there the night before shows that that was not his role. His role was to give a ride and act as an interpreter. And he did that unwittingly and without the intent to join a conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute a ton of marijuana. As far as breaking it down, the government would have you believe that the next logical step in this proceeding would have been to break hundreds of pottery jars, leave them sitting there in a big heap in the middle of somebody else's yard, load the marijuana into Mr. Piatto's van, and drive off. That, on these facts, would be an unreasonable inference.
Thank you, Mr. Byrd.
Thank you.
The court thanks Mr. Albers, Mr. Byrd, Mr. Nelson for your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to your client as well as the court. The case is taken under advisement.